All right, we are coming to the end of Jacob's stay with Laban, and we're at chapter 30, verse 25. This is after the competition between the wives and handmaidens for children. Now we return to, I'm tempted to say, from the world of women to the world of men. There is something of that. That is, it was about childbearing, and now it's going to be about wages, which in the ancient world was a clearly divided distinction between the place that women occupied and the place that men occupied in ancient society, and even often today, but certainly then. So I just read this interview, I don't remember where, with Michelle Obama about the fact that he always comments on her clothes. And she said to him, get out of my closet and go save the world. So there was like, this is, you know, you have your place and I have mine. And while I doubt that Rachel said that to Jacob, there's something of the same in this verse 25. After Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, give me leave to go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you that I may go. For well you know what services I've rendered you. Okay, so first of all, it's interesting that he asks permission to leave, and it's not clear whether that's a courtesy or that's obligatory, that he's not, that he can't go, that he's some kind of indentured servitude that he owes Laban this time, but he feels like he's worked off his time, and now he wants not only to go, but also to go with his wives and his children. But notice he says, give me my wives and my children. So it could also be that if you're the worker for somebody, almost like a slave system, and you give birth, that they in some way belong to the master, and he has to release them to you if you're leaving, which, as you know, is a theme of slave literature from early days up until today. There's a lot written about that in the Deep South in the time of slavery, that children belonged to the master, they didn't belong to the to their biological parents. The most acclaimed recent book about that is Beloved, Toni Morrison's book. Anyway, but Laban said to him, if you'll indulge me, I've learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me on your account. Now that's a strange sort of thing to say. That is, he's doing better, obviously, and he somehow learned by whatever means that he's doing better because of Jacob. And divination clearly isn't anything that the Bible's all that happy with, right? The Bible doesn't like magic. And the reason that it doesn't like magic is the same reason that some of the medievals didn't like magic, even though there's a lot of magic in Judaism, a lot of magic, right? All you have to do is read the stories of Isaac Bashevis Singer or think about the fact that people touch a mezuzah when they leave, or if they leave and they haven't touched the mezuzah, they come back and touch the mezuzah, right? The line between magic and obsessive compulsive disorder is very, very thin. But the reason in theory that Jews don't like magic is there are only two explanations of a magical spell. One is that it forces God to do something. The other is that it appeals to a power apart from God. And either one is not good. So you shouldn't be able to do magic because what you should do is pray and then God decides whether he wants to do it or not. But a formula that forces God to do something, and yet those formula are all over the Jewish tradition. There's a rabbi named Trachtenberg who wrote two books about Jewish magic and superstition. And he records all the many, many, many spells and amulets and charms and so on that Jews have used throughout the generations. So I don't want to suggest that Jews haven't used magic. They've used a lot of magic, but in theory, magic shouldn't be, right? Magic shouldn't work and you shouldn't do it. So Laban, this is consistent with what we know about Laban, which is he does bad stuff and he in, engages in bad things, and he may be part of the extended family of the Jewish people, but he's somehow both inside it and outside it. And he continued, name the wages due from me, and I will pay you. Now, here you can actually interpret this if you want, according to Lavan's benefit, because he doesn't say, Jacob doesn't say, you owe me money. Lavan brings up the issue of money. But I suppose that they both understood that nobody works for 14 years and then leaves with just wife and children and no wages. So whoever, but nonetheless, it is true that Lavan is the first one to bring up the issue of money. And he said, you know how well I've served you and how your livestock has fared with me. Well, he's just repeating what we already know. For the little you had before I came has grown to much, since the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. And now, when shall I make provision for my own household? All right, this is the core of Jacob's argument. You've made a lot of money off me. What about my own? What about my kids, right? And here, there is, you can hear in what Jacob says, the old grievance, which is, I've done everything for you, but what about for me? And that seems to be the case from what follows, because it looks like everything that Jacob has done has only enhanced Lavan's house, which is what happens when you're an employer. If you have a good employee and they grow the business for you, then you decide as the employer whether you want to give them a bonus, but you're not obligated to. That's what an employee does. An employee works hard and the owner benefits, right? This is exactly, by the way, part of the core of the critique of Marxism, which is, in Marxism, the complaint is that the workers do not own the means of production, and therefore their work is to the benefit of the people who own the means of production, and you live off the labor of others, and that's a fundamental inequality, and therefore a Marxist society would be one in which the workers and the owners were identical, right? Never worked, but at least that's the idea. And there is clearly, the Marxist critique puts its finger on something that is fundamentally unfair, right? Which is, if you're lucky enough to inherit, for example, a business from your parents, all those people who work on it and who know the business and who've done it for 30 years, all of a sudden they're working to put money in your pocket, right? Even though you may be indifferent to it. So the same thing is true here. Jacob is blessed and Jacob works hard and Lavan benefits. And remember, Lavan didn't even do anything to recruit Jacob. He basically showed up one day. And the analogy of, you know, of you inherited from your father, it's exactly right, which is that Jacob has inherited this. Lavan has inherited this person because he's a relative, which, by the way, raises an interesting question. If you had a fortune, would you leave it to your kids? Because some, i.e. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, decided no, that they wouldn't leave their fortune to their kids because it's deleterious. Although I think Buffett's kids are in his company, which already, you know, that's a big advantage. But it is an interesting ethical question, the whole question of an inheritance tax and whether what your parents, grandparents do should benefit you is an interesting theoretical question, but we're not going to decide it here. But he said, what shall I pay you? And Jacob said, pay me nothing. Now, pay me nothing is an opening gambit in a negotiation, right? Obviously, he wants to end up with something. So he's thought this out before he's come to Lavan, because he knows Lavan's going to say, okay, what do you want? And he's going to say, nothing. I don't want anything from you. I don't want to diminish your holdings, he says. If you'll do this thing for me, I'll again pasture and keep your flocks. Let me pass through your whole flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted animal, every dark-colored sheep, every spotted and speckled goat. Such shall be my wages. Now, what spotted and speckled sheep are worth more or less?
Less.
So in other words, he's saying, give me the dross. Give me the stuff you don't want. I'll just take that. That's all, you know, just that will be fine. Now, obviously, we know he has a plan, but for Lavan, he's taking the bad stuff off of his hands, which is very
acids.
What's that?
The toxic assets.
Assets. Exactly so. That's right. All the bad debts in sheep, that's all he's doing. In the future, when you go over my wages, let my honesty toward you testify for me. If there are among my goats any that aren't speckled or spotted, or any sheep that aren't dark colored, they got there by theft. And Lavan said, very well, let it be as you say. Now, I read an article that I did not bring to inflict on you, but from the, actually, he's part of the Weinberg family. Matis Weinberg is his name. His uncle is the one who founded Eshet Torah. His uncle was Noah Weinberg. His father was the head of Neri Yisrael in Baltimore. And he wrote, he's a very learned and thoughtful scholar. He teaches in Israel. And he wrote that Jacob, and here's, I'll tell you the part that I go with and the part that I'm not sure that I understand. He said that Jacob was a simple man, and that simple men act like mirrors. They reflect whoever they're dealing with. So when Jacob dealt with Esav, who was brutal and cunning, he dealt with him brutally and cunningly, right? He said, if you're so hungry, give me your birthright. It's the kind of thing Esav would do. When he dealt with Lavan, he was tricky and subtle, because that's the way Lavan is. And his argument was that Jacob is, in fact, an ish tam, which is why the prayer says, emet li Yaakov, that Jacob is truth, right? Chesed la Avraham, Avraham is chesed, and Jacob is truth. He said truth is something that reflects back to the person what they really are. And I thought it was a really good article and very interesting. He went into more detail. The one person with whom it doesn't work, though, is Isaac. And he doesn't talk about Isaac, because remember, Jacob cheats Isaac, but Isaac is not a cheat. Right, Jacob fools his father, but there it doesn't seem to work. However, it's worth more thought. I have to go back and read and see if he mentions Isaac at all. I read it quickly yesterday, and it is worth thinking about whether that, you know, as we go on and we read the rest of Jacob's story, which we will, whether that is a plausible or even a possible interpretation of Jacob. Understanding all the time, of course, that the tradition would not want Jacob to be anything less than good. Okay, so he says, pay me nothing, just give me the dark and spotted sheep, and I'm going to read you something about that in just a second. But that same day, and but is interpretive here, it just, vayasar bayom hahu, on that day, he removed the streaked and spotted he-goats and all the speckled and spotted she-goats, everyone that had white on it, and all the dark-colored sheep, and left them in charge of his sons. And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Lavan's flock. Jacob then got fresh shoots of poplar, and of almond and plane, and peeled white stripes in them, laying bare the white of the shoots. The rods that he peeled he set up in front of the goats in the troughs, the water receptacles, and the goats they came to drink from. The mating occurred when they came to drink, and since the goats mated by the rods, the goats brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted young. All right, so the idea here is that what they saw when they mated was how their children looked. Now, one possibility is this is an old superstition. I remember my mother telling me that when she was pregnant with my oldest brother, that a circus came on television, and my great-grandmother jumped in front of the TV because they were going to show monkeys, and she was sure, of course, that, you know, my brother would come out Simeon. So
he loves this story.
Actually. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good story for younger brothers to tell about older brothers. It's from the same superstition, that what you look at when you give birth or what you look at when you're pregnant is what your child will look like. But I have a...
End of the story.
What's that?
Yeah,
right. Oh, he looks normal. More or less. A little, maybe. So Maybe that's why I became a geneticist, actually. Never thought about that. I'll have to ask him if that had any, because he does, no, it's Steve. He does genetics research. So he works for a company that does. Anyway, so. What's that?
Was he on television?
No, that was my brother who's a sociologist. Yeah, different brother. So here's what, he was on 60 Minutes, that brother was on 60 Minutes, right. So here's here's what Robert Alter says about this. The mechanism of Jacob's ingenious scheme has long perplexed commentators. I should say so. At least on the surface, it appears to involve the age-old belief that sensory impressions at the moment of conception affect the embryo. Okay? In other words, what you see the moment you conceive, that has something to do with how the child is going to turn out. All right? Here, the peeled rods with their strips of white against dark bark would impart the trait of spots or brindle markings to the offspring conceived. The same effect would then be achieved for the sheep by making them face the flock of speckled goats during their own mating time. Yehuda Felix, an authority on biblical flora and fauna, and I'll bet you didn't know that there was such a thing, but there is, has proposed that the peeled rods are only a dodge, a gesture to popular belief, while Jacob is actually practicing sound principles of animal breeding. Using a Mendelian table, remember Mendel, right, genetics, Felix argues that the recessive traits would have shown up in 25% of the animals in the first breeding season, 12.5% in the second breeding season, and 6.25% in the third season. Jacob is careful to encourage the breeding of only the more vigorous animals, which, according to Felix, would be more likely to be heterozygotes bearing the recessive genes. It's noteworthy that Jacob makes no mention of the peeled rods in the next chapter when he tells his wife how he acquired the flocks. So maybe Jacob was demonstrating an early knowledge of genetics, or maybe it was a miracle. Go ahead.
I just want to pass around email to get all your emails, because apparently I'm missing some of yours, and just so that what happened last week doesn't happen again. Okay, so if you wouldn't mind just writing your name and your email, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I mean, it depends how much you believe that. I mean, it's the same issue with the 10 plagues, for example. I read an absolutely ingenious book. I reviewed it for the Jerusalem Post several years ago about how the 10 plagues could all be explained reasonably or rationally. I mean, I'll give you one example of how he tries to explain. This is an English evangelical scholar, but clearly a very smart guy. He says the hardest one to explain is the death of the firstborn, right? That's the hardest to explain. So his explanation is that you, in times of famine and limited food, the corded grain is given first to the prize cattle, they got sick, and then to your firstborn children eat it first, and they're the ones who got sick. It's a good explanation. It doesn't work, by the way, for why only firstborn sons died, and also it's very implausible that all these families only gave food to their firstborn, but, you know, he tried. It was a good try. In other words, if you don't want to see it as just it's a miracle of God, or if you don't want to see it as just it's a story and you want to find a scientific explanation, it seems as though Felix's explanation is a good one, that every flock is going to have a certain amount. And if Jacob walks away with 10% of Laban's flock, that's a huge number of sheep and goats and so on to build his own flock from. And since it's a recessive gene, every chance that the spotted and speckled sheep will have normal kids, right? So next generation, he's going to have children who didn't watch television when the monkeys were, right? Okay, so that at least is now, when you go on, just to finish off, because I'd like to polish off chapter 30 today, and we're close, and there isn't that much in it to talk about, but there is in the next chapter. But Jacob dealt separately with the sheep. He made these animals face the streaked or wholly dark-colored animals in Laban's flock, and so he produced special flocks for himself, which he didn't put with Laban's flock. Moreover, when the sturdier animals were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the troughs in full view of the animals so that they mated by the rods, but with the feebler animals, he wouldn't place them there. Thus, the feeble ones went to Laban and the sturdy to Jacob. So the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to his own large flocks, maidservants and menservants, camels and asses. Now, to go back to Matthias Weinberg's theory and an alternative reading, let me put it that way. Weinberg's theory, remember, is that Lavan reflects, is that Jacob reflects back to you whatever your behavior is. That's what it means to be a person of truth. And Lavan clearly substituted Leah and for Rachel, and also made him work all these years that, and apparently made him work without any wages, because at the end of it, he has nothing of his own except his children. Right? So his revenge is an entirely legal scheme. He's not doing anything illegal, right? An entirely legal scheme to essentially defraud Lavan of a great number of his flock. And that's how Jacob, in this instance, reflects back to Lavan who Lavan is. The other reading thus far of Jacob, and I would say the more immediately obvious to one who reads the Bible without without just as it goes along now, if you're at this point in the story and you haven't read the end and looked back, the more obvious reading is that this is perfectly consistent with the Jacob we know. This is the same Jacob who followed his mother into fooling his father, and earlier, even before his mother decided to fool his father, negotiated with his brother when his brother was under duress, right? Either real or imagined. Even if Esau wasn't genuinely starving, he spoke about himself that way, he acted that way, and Jacob perfectly legally took advantage of it in the same way that he's perfectly legally taking advantage of Lavan. And so if you want to see Jacob as consistently, I don't want to say dishonest in his dealings, but less than fully honest, not full disclosure, the kind of person who would say, you know, mistakes were made, as opposed to saying, I'm sorry, I blew it, right? If you want to see him that way, then I think that this wouldn't surprise you at all. This is exactly how Jacob acts. It's how he acts with Esau. It's how he acts with Isaac. It's even a little bit how he acts with Rachel and Leah, which is when he doesn't want responsibility, when Rachel says, how come I don't have kids, it's your fault. When he doesn't want responsibility, he disclaims it. Presumably, I mean, I may be, you know, this is just an assumption, but presumably when other people act in a way he does want, even if that way is at least marginally questionable, like when Rachel and Leah bring Bilhah and Zilpah to him, he just accepts it because it's good for him. So he may as well take their maidservants. Whereas Abraham, remember, when Sarah proposed Hagar, Abraham was uncomfortable with that. Abraham didn't keep quiet, but Jacob, when he has two wives and they propose two handmaidens, not a peep do we hear from Jacob, right? So for all those reasons, even though Rabbi Weinberg makes obviously a scholarly and a clever case, the easier case to make is just, this is Jacob the way we've always known him from the moment that he was holding on to Esau's heel and his name meant, you know, supplanter, the one who takes the place of others. That's what he has done and that's what he continues to do. And we will see, and what happens now is the sort of the next phase in the next couple of chapters are when things really don't go Jacob's way in one way or another and he has to confront the consequences of his choices. And that's what we're going to face in the next couple of chapters, and for that matter, for the rest of Bereishit, because the story of Joseph is in part the story of the consequences of the choices of Jacob. Okay, let's stop there and take questions and comments. Yeah. I'm not either, but...
Jacob's story in length. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it kind of gets into Joseph too. So is his the biggest story about the patriarchs?
Yes, his is, especially if you include the Joseph story as being inside the frame of the Jacob story. Yeah. His is the longest. And I would say also that with the exception of David, who, as I said, I hope we will study in this class. Maybe even at the end of Genesis, we'll move on to David, we'll see. But with the exception of David, he's the most detailed character. The truth is you don't know as much about Moses' character as you do about Jacob, or certainly about David. And in part, I'm tempted to say, I don't know if this is true, and this has just occurred to me, so, you know, it's the kind of thing that you could decide it's not true tomorrow. I'm tempted to say that it's for the famous Tolstoy reason. You know how Tolstoy begins Anna Karenina by saying, all happy families are alike, but all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. So Moses is not perfect, but he's pretty close. And so Jacob is far from perfect, and David, God knows, I mean, you know, David makes Jacob look like Moses. People who grow, people who have flaws and grow and change and struggle and backslide, all of that, you tend to explore their characters more interestingly. It's very hard to write a novel about a perfect person. We're exaggerating about Moses. Moses has flaws and he does bad things and he gets rebuked and he has struggles, but you never get the sense with Moses, at least I don't get the sense, that he has a fundamental struggle with his very nature, with his character, in the way that Jacob does and David does. The basic struggle that Moses has is, do I really want to accept this giant burden that God has given me? And the truth is, God doesn't give him a choice. Although there is a midrash, by the way, that a king sent someone to draw a picture of Moses. This is a very interesting midrash. And the artist comes back with a picture of an ugly man. And he says, you must not have the right, that can't be the right one. And he goes back and Moses says, no, you drew me correctly. This is actually what my deep nature is, but I had to overcome it in order to become Moses. So the rabbis at least did have that sense that Moses had to grow and change. But in the Bible, it's not depicted nearly as much. So, yeah.
Let me see if I got the thing about the speckled fly
right.
Correct.
Okay.
Here's the way I'm getting it. Jacob knows that he can take the speckled and spotted ones because within two or three generations, using correct breeding, he's going to get a much better flock. Laban doesn't know it, so he makes this deal, and it works out for him.
It seems so. The only addition is the strange thing about how he has them, how he has the sheep breed. And it seems as though the sheep that he's having breed are not just speckled and spotted sheep. You know, he's having all sorts of sheep breed looking at speckled and spotted rods. And somehow, miraculously, that produces speckled and spotted sheep. But, yeah.
I think there was a suggestion that something else is going on here. It says, by a Ephraim had some, the flock was stimulated.
Mm-hmm.
To breed more.
I have no doubt that there were ancient techniques to get animals to breed more prolifically than they would breed if they were just left alone. So you're probably right. And Jacob, if Jacob is as good at growing Laban's flock as they both agree that he is, then he must just be good at this. I mean, you can be better or worse at being a shepherd just as you can at anything else. So you're probably right. That buried in this is the idea that he's getting them to breed more, which would change, obviously, the number of, you increase the overall number, then you're going to increase. And also, when you increase the overall number, although I don't know that this applies to this, when you increase the overall number of any population, things change. I mean, grasshoppers become locusts in part by population density, right? When you get one, it's grasshopper. When you get hundreds of thousands in a small area, all of a sudden it's a swarm of locusts, and they do actually change even physiologically. So that may be. It's an interesting thought.
The idea that you deal with someone according to their behavior.
Yes.
Can we extrapolate that to modern times and say that's how we have to deal with Iran?
So no, it's a, I mean, this, it's a very interesting question, because people do use that, that exact, and there is that, that statement does exist in the Jewish tradition, you know, with the kind kindly and with the cruel cruelly, and those who are kind to the cruel end up being cruel to the kind, right? I would say the answer is this, an answer is this. The problem with that analysis is that sometimes you can change people's nature by the way you treat them. And the idea of a soft answer turns away wrath is often true. It is often true, you know? And so if somebody approaches you in a belligerent way, the automatic assumption that therefore you have to be belligerent back can escalate as opposed to de-escalate. So it depends. It really does depend. No, that's why when you see these cliches, they're too simple. Sometimes, yes, I mean, you know, Chamberlain was wrong. You couldn't appease Hitler because Hitler was fundamentally unappeasable. But for most, you know, for most people, Chamberlain could have been right. And so it wasn't crazy for him to think that he should go and try to negotiate with. Remember, we know a lot more about Hitler now than he knew then. And a lot of the world agreed with him. And when Chamberlain came back to Britain, which we don't remember anymore, he was greeted as a hero. It wasn't that everybody said, oh my God, how can you do this? Churchill was an exception, right? Peace in our time. Churchill was an exception. But even though we think now of Churchill as a prophet, he was thought of as very eccentric, and he was very eccentric in his time. And he thought a lot of things that didn't work. And in the First World War, he was a goat, the opposite of a hero, because he was the one who championed the Gallipoli invasion, which was a disaster. So the answer is nobody knows in advance, you know? And when it works out, you're a genius, and when it doesn't, you're not. But I wouldn't say it's always true that you have to treat someone the way they treat you. And the one other reason why I would say it's not always true is, and this also you might argue against Weinberg's thesis, is that there's a certain integrity to being the same even when people around you change. And all of us know people who are fundamentally always the same, and there's something beautiful about that. I took my daughter to Philadelphia and to Harrisburg, and in Philadelphia we saw my closest friend for most of my life, and he's incapable of speaking differently from the way he speaks to adults, to children. And he spoke to her exactly the same way because he really only has one mode of, and he started to ask her about political questions, and I mean, that's just the way he always does. I remember going to his house when I was a kid, and he and his father would sit in front of the news and they would argue with each other about politics. And so he started to ask one of the inheritance questions that I mentioned before. He asked her, by the way, if your dad was really rich, do you think it's good for him to leave you money, or you think it's not good for him to leave? Out of nowhere. So as we're walking out, she loved it. Loved it. She said that she'd never sat with anyone who talked to her exactly the same way that they talked to me. And she thought it was great. And there's something beautiful about that. So it's hard to say. Hard to say. Yeah.
Going back to the death of the firstborn, have you heard the theory or the explanation that the beds of the firstborn were lower than the other beds? I don't know how that...
No, I haven't. Hmm. But it's an... And it may be true. What I don't know is that only true for firstborn boys?
Right.
And so... And I don't know what they would attribute that to, but it's an interesting, listen, I will, oh good, I can actually say this while Dahlia is here, so I don't have to send her an email about it. Galit Dayan, the wife of the consul general, got her PhD in Egyptology. She's an Egyptologist, and she believes that there's evidence that Jews were slaves in Egypt and wants to do an evening on it, and that's something that we could ask her about. So we'll plan that together. I think it would be a great program, and she's a terrific human being. So, yes?
My concern in all of this is that our forefathers are supposed to be our heroes.
I know. I'm sorry, that's exactly why you get articles like Rabbi Weinberg's, because the rabbis try to use the lives of the patriarch as things to aspire to, and there are things to aspire to about them, but I mean, it seems to me that you can learn tremendous lessons, but they're not always lessons of emulation. Sometimes they're lessons of, you know, right, this is what they had to go through to get to where they went. But I don't see how you can honestly read through even just the book of Genesis and say, boy, I've just read through a book of people who I really want to be exactly like. It just doesn't, and it takes an enormous amount of interpretation for the rabbis to turn them into that. And what happens is, when you look at the Midrash, they will often indicate, or you look at the commentators, they'll often indicate that that's not, you know, there are cracks in the attempt to make them as perfect, because they're so manifestly not perfect that it's just hard to do. It's just hard to pretend that they are. Yes. Right. That's exactly. That's, by the way, that's probably, not only is that exactly why, or close to exactly why, the rabbis did that, because Jews were attacked, but if you remember that that's what Professor Firestone said last year he was here, mm-hmm. He said that the Muslims look at the Bible and say, of course, look how messed up, but our counter to that, I mean, not our counter as Jews, because the rabbis will defend all the actions in the way they defend them. But my counter to that would be that to understand that human beings are flawed, even the greatest among them, is actually a much more profound lesson than to pretend there are perfect people walking around. Because you realize that Christians, for example, have a much harder time than Jews do, because they have to defend Jesus not just as a perfect person, but as a God. And everything he does that seems objectionable, they really have to explain away, right? And the same thing with Muhammad, who in the Muslim tradition plays a greater exemplary role than Moses does in the Jewish tradition. So when Muhammad marries an 8-year-old, for example, they really have to defend that in a way that we don't have to defend Jacob for marrying two wives, you know, not in the same way. But yeah, it is a problem. People do point to the Torah and say, you know, look at what you did. Look at the Jews. I mean, that's a staple of medieval anti-Semitic literature. Look how the Jews steal. They steal the birthright. They steal the land. So, yeah.
I mean, I know they look at that, but then in every human being, isn't it supposed to be like Yetzer Hara? And
I think so, yes.
Where is the Yetzer Hara in Jacob? I mean, everything so far I've seen is...
Wait. Where's the Yetzer HaTov? Okay, he worked for 7 years for the woman he loved. He clearly was beloved of his mother. He has a relationship with God, and he sees this dream of the angels going up and down. There are hints, more than hints. I mean, this is a special and a gifted man. He works for Lavan, and Lavan's business grows tremendously. He's not a normal person. But I don't think that you can say yet that he's grown into a tzaddik. That takes time. I should bring you this letter. I saw a beautiful letter from a wonderful, I think it was Huttner. I think it was Yitzchak Huttner, I'm not sure, who was a Rosh Yeshiva. And he wrote this letter to a young man who basically wrote to him and said, I despair of ever becoming, he didn't say a tzaddik, but I despair of ever becoming a good man. I have so many struggles and so many spirit. And Huttner said, you know, when you read about the lives of holy people, we do a great disservice because you don't see what they were like when they're young. Mm-hmm. Everyone writes about them after they've already become great. But believe me, he said, we all had struggles. We all had pain. What you're going through is not unlike what I went through and what other people went through. But you're not seeing that part of our lives. You only see the end of it. So maybe, and I saved the letter somewhere because I really thought it was wonderful that he would write that. And maybe that's what we're seeing here, is we're seeing what everyone goes through. It's just that since we know that he ends up being Jacob, it's hard to see. Yeah.
Isn't that the same thing that every writer goes through, whether they're writing it?
That's why biographies are so great. Biographies are great because you pick up the biography of some famous guy, a politician, a writer, an artist, whatever it is, And all of a sudden you see the letters that they, I mean, like you see, Churchill is a good example of this. You see the letters that he wrote to his parents when he was a schoolboy, because they're preserved, and they're pitiful. You know, he wants their love, and he's despairing, and he doesn't think they really love him, or they're not close to him the way he wants them to be close. And you think, you know, you think of the guy who won the Second World War and effectively saved the world, but he was 10 years old once, and he wasn't Winston Churchill. So in that sense, a good biography can be really comforting and helpful and inspiring because you see someone grow, but it has to be a good biography. The same thing about the, you know, biographies of Lincoln or, anyway, so.
Mm-hmm. The same with Laban, he lived with family for many years. And maybe, I mean, it's a message that if I see someone going the wrong path, I should just try to help them out and work with them and just let them be who they are and use it against them again.
Yeah, that's sort of the principle of judo, right? You use someone's own momentum against them. And that's what he's doing in a way, right? He's using Lavan's own, I don't want you to pay me any money, right? Then he would get into a struggle with Lavan. He's saying instead, give me the stuff you don't want. So you're right, he's using Lavan's own momentum against him. And sometimes there are the assumption that you can change someone is a really dangerous one. So
he has the same path as
yourself. Right. So he it may be that he moves. He does what the Talmud says God does. It says that God moves people along the path they want to go. So maybe that's what Jacob's doing. So that's yeah.
I need one explanation about what you said about
sure.
Jews and Muslims.
Yes. Well, they don't think it's a flaw.
Mm-hmm. They emulate. You said that they might have a hard time comparing Muhammad to Moses because Muhammad is supposed to be more perfect.
Right.
But they don't see it as a flaw.
No, of course, they don't. Right.
I mean, they don't need to explain about marrying a 9-year-old.
Right. Right.
Just make laws.
Exactly. They don't need to. Look, the Jewish tradition contains a lot that would make you very uncomfortable. I don't want to, just like the rabbis, you know, now it's coming out who went all around Gaza and told them that this was a holy war and it didn't matter who they killed and they could kill anyone they wanted. It's a very, the problem is, a problem is that we're no better than the people we're reading about in the Bible, and most of us are worse. So when you speak in God's name about something, and it gets filtered through the very imperfect human apparatus, you get, you know, trouble. You get a lot of trouble. Yeah.
Does not emulating the patriarchs from the Jewish from the Old
right.
Testament, is that a conservative reform belief within the Jews? Do the Orthodox believe that we need to emulate that?
Well, no, I think they wouldn't say, the answer is yes and no. Nobody in traditional Jewish learning, you don't say grow up to be like Jacob, right? You say you can learn from the behavior of the Avot, which anyone would say, but in order to understand their behavior, you have to read what the rabbis teach you that their behavior meant and why they did it. So for some specific behaviors, the rabbis will say, look, it was okay for Jacob to do this because he was Jacob. And we understand why Jacob did it. But that doesn't mean that you should do it, right? Nobody would say you can cheat your father because Jacob fooled his father. No, you have to understand this was Jacob. It was a separate set of circumstances. He was doing something that Rebecca told him to do, and this was a message from God. What I think you would get that you don't get here as much is a far greater tendency to assume that anything the patriarchs did must be right. Doesn't mean that you should emulate it, but that it must be right or that they would not have done it. For example, they'll say that, when Isaac came down from the mountain after the Akedah, he went to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever and studied Torah there, right? And therefore, Isaac conducted his life in accordance with the precepts of Torah. Now, I see that as a legendary idea. I don't believe that anyone studied Torah in the time of Isaac, right? But a lot of people in the Orthodox world would take that quite literally and would assume that Isaac and Jacob and Joseph all had extensive knowledge of Torah and laws of Torah and understood what the Torah was going to be about, even in advance of it being given. So the way that you evaluate their behavior, especially because they were closer to God, is very different from the way you would evaluate your behavior or mine. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Rather than Abraham.
Right. But even there, it doesn't mean all the details of their life. Right? Ephraim and Manasseh refers to something specific, which is one worked and one studied. So what you want is that God should give you, that's really what you're saying to a child when you say Ephraim and Manasseh, is may you both be learned and also productive in the world. Oh. Right? Because we don't know anything about Ephraim and Manasseh's life, really. So exactly. That's why you don't canonize someone until they're dead, right? Because you want to make sure no uncomfortable information comes out. Right, but it's true. Nobody says you should be like Jacob. Still, that's the idea. That's the idea, that you want someone to embody both those characteristics. And for a woman, you say all four, right? Sarah, Rivka, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and they're four very different women. So it's interesting that you name all four of them.
Going along my colleague's comment about the patriarchs, I always thought that all these stories before Moses and before giving of the Torah on Sinai were just showing the evolution of our people. And that
according to whom?
The way I was taught about
right.
Judaism. And after Torah, then you read the Bible, then everyone's more accountable to upholding all those.
They're more accountable to specifics, but it depends who you ask and how much they think they knew. And also, you realize a lot of the stuff in the Torah, which is not specific Torah law, people are assumed to know, right? When, for example, when the men of Shechem, as we will come to, when they rape Dinah, how do they know that rape is wrong? Why are Shimon and Levi upset? It doesn't say before that rape is wrong. Why do we know that it's wrong for Cain to kill Abel? It doesn't say that it's wrong. All those sorts of things. I mean, look, God destroys almost the entire world on the assumption that all these people know what they're doing is wrong. So there's a lot of innate moral knowledge that the Torah assumes yes?
I'm puzzled by the fact that Jacob represents truth because he reflects the other person when he's not acting out of any kind of inherent goodness.
Maybe. He thinks he is. I understand what you're saying. The tradition assumes that Jacob is, right? That Jacob is, in fact, carrying out God's design and knowingly carrying out God's design. That's why he takes Bilhah and Zilpah, because he knows he has to have the children that will develop into the 12 tribes. You know, Jacob is given a degree of foreknowledge that you don't see in the Bible, but that the rabbis assume. So what he's doing to Laban is especially praiseworthy, because he could have just said, give me my wages, but he's not. He's saying, give me the stuff you don't want, and I'll make my own wages out of them. All the things that we're seeing as potentially not nice, right? The same thing with Isaac and with Esau. Here, Jacob sees that he has to carry out God's design in the world, and in the process, it requires hurting people to some extent. I mean, Esau gets upset, but he doesn't kill anyone, and he still manages somehow to have God's design succeed. So depends how you Yeah. That's why it's, I mean, it all depends on how you want to view the characters here. And they, as I said, in the traditional reading, they're very well defended. But we'll look over Jacob's whole life when we get to the end of it, because there are several different ways of reading how he moved through it. Let's take a last question.
Malum in se, the Latin term in legal.
Right, as malum prohibitum and malum in se. Malum prohibitum is a law that you don't do because it's prohibited. Like if you come to a red light and you can see in the middle of the desert, and you can see for 30 miles around that no one is there, not going through the red light is malum prohibitum, right? It's not, whereas a malum in se is something that you understand is wrong, like, you know, stabbing someone. And that's right. The Torah clearly has, they divide it differently, chukim and mishpatim, but things that are clearly wrong that everybody would understand is wrong. And that's why, I'll just close with this. In the New York debate, and then he didn't repeat it in the next two for obvious reasons, Hitchens, in his opening comments in the debate we had at Emmanuel, he said, don't believe that the Jews were so stupid that they had to go to Sinai to find out that it's wrong to kill. He said, that's, you know, the Bible is ridiculous in trying to, and that was easy. I was just waiting for him to finish because I said, I guess you got that. I guess you didn't read the book of Genesis, because right there in the very first stories, Cain kills Abel. Everybody assumes it's wrong and nobody waits for Sinai. So they knew that the point of Sinai wasn't to tell people that murder is wrong. It was to say that it's woven into the fabric of the universe. It's about God's will, not about human will. But that's exactly, I mean, the Torah assumes that about a lot of stuff, that certain things are wrong, and that any decent, thoughtful human being would know this. That's why Jews have a right to expect a certain level of behavior from even those who aren't Jewish or read the Torah or whatever, because it's part of just being human. So, all right. Thank you.